I'm Christopher Lydon, listening in on the birth pangs, the first little peeps of a speculative peace movement. Is there an art of peace to rival the arts of war, to break this general dread of permanent war? And specifically, in this moment of early summer 2011, who has the tactics and strategies at the ready to make the most of a human decency movement that sprung up with courage and power in the Arab Middle East? This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. For 3 days inside the biggest log cabin in Canada, artists and writers from all over have been playing with questions both scientific and whimsical about peace. Will global peace come only, as Ronald Reagan predicted, when aliens invade the planet? And what if those aliens come in peace? I put it to this wrap-up takeaway session of the conference. There's a call on the line from Damascus, from Cairo, from Jerusalem. Somebody wants to know, what have you got for us? Goes without saying, they're calling from a place of national security, states that aren't secure, and peace processes that never seem to get to peace. What is the closest thing you've got to a usable alternative? James Dedarian is a writer and filmmaker, teaches international relations at Brown University, and he organized this conference. James, I asked people to sort of think of the situation in the Middle East today just because the events of the last 6 months or so have revealed such a bankrupt system, and it's governments fighting their own people systematically, and the people are onto it, of course. The whole world can see the manipulations of war and peace, the phonification of every process of politics. So it seems to me it's a kind of place to start entirely again. I'd like to ask you two questions. One, in your view of the world, what's the rebalancing to be done between the so-called civil society, people, the Tahrir Square crowds, and the so-called state?
In this context of this question, I would say that violence and war is the means by which a very ruthless minority imposed their will on a passive majority. Mm. What's changed, and we could get into those reasons why, is the passivity no longer exists. It's been, you know, the sleeping giant's been poked one too many times. And we could get into whether or not, you know, this is because of a new form of network technology, social media as a catalyst, or just pure exhaustion of the regimes themselves. But the fact that nonviolence was the means predominantly by which the passive many chose to resist and, you know, two cases now overthrow and possibly three, that ruthless few, is part of the reasons why we held this event. I don't know if it's a zeitgeist, if it's some Mayan prophecy, or it is just simply the end of the long war that was the term used for post 9/11 conflict that's besetting, you know, international politics. But I think we are at a moment where if you get a language, if you get a passion, and you get the means to get the message out, the natural will of people to overthrow that type of domination, oppression, will be served. And, you know, as facilitators of that, and I don't believe in the heroic intellectual. I don't have, you know, none of us at this table do, has any kind of blueprint or grand theory for making that happen. But we do by, I think, the fact of our ability to mobilize a lot of heavy-duty intellectual firepower with some image-making capacity, message-making capabilities, have a small, maybe, you know, significant impact. But it's really happening there, and we're still trying to make sense of it, trying to keep up with events. Like, you know, scholars are often always lagging behind the latest idea or the latest, you know, movements, purpose and ultimate goals. But I'd like to believe, and, you know, to the extent civil society and the state coexist and need to recalibrate, that there is a new networked capacity that did not exist at the time where, like, Hegel and others first posed the idea of civil society being prior to the unified democratic state.
The second question follows from that, but it has to do with the emphasis in your work and this conference on arts, which sounds a little too sweet to be true. And yet these last 3 days have been full of instances of filmmaking, music, literature, poetry that, when the planets are right, can feel like earth-shaking forces. Make the case for the arts in a peace process.
Well, it comes as well from a frustration of my own background, my own training, to find the right vocabulary metaphors. You know, coming out of political science, where you assume everybody's a rational actor, you begin to see the shortcomings of that very quickly because, you know, emotions, good and bad, love and hate, envy, but also hospitality, drive so much of world history. So it was really to get beyond the disciplines, get outside the borders of the United States, and find, hopefully, a group of people who are willing to be imaginative and creative and push their own models, have them be pushed. I think for poets and let's not, you know, make this too pie in the sky, as you put it, but I think there's an effort to get closer to the truth and not to be so willing to use lies, deceit, and disinformation to maintain your power, but rather go down the path of truth-seeking, never quite reaching it perhaps, that makes the creative arts more appealing when it comes to finding a way of being. That's why we put this together.
Steve Del Rosso started out as a career diplomat in the U.S. Foreign Service. He is by now a peace philanthropist, program director at the Carnegie Corporation's Peace and Security Program. Steve Del Rosso, would you go back to the origins of this conference a century ago and to your great patron, Andrew Carnegie, one of the great industrialists, robber barons, and peacemakers of American history, an anti-imperialist, key figure in the anti-imperialist league, who abhorred the American intervention in the Philippines around the turn of the 20th century, and asked you to keep the idea alive. What's the report to Andrew Carnegie these days, and what is?
Well, I have to keep in mind that I'd like to stay employed, so I will be gentle on the good Scotsman. He was an inveterate optimist. He believed that all is well because all grows better. And he was inspired by his good friend, Herbert Spencer, that mankind evolved not only biologically but intellectually, and that we were in a positive trajectory.
Do we still believe that?
Well, that's what I have to tell him, Mr. Carnegie, that the world is even more complicated than it was when you were in the anti-imperialist league in the late 19th century, that the means that mankind has to destroy itself that they didn't in your day now present a whole series of threats, not just from traditional warfare, but from the environment and other sources.
Sandra Cisneros, from San Antonio, Texas, the novelist of the universal bestseller The House on Mango Street. She teaches writing, and she wants to make a difference. She knows she does. Sandra, if there's another thread that I take away from here, it's a very simple notion that empathy, which is to say the ability to see the world from an adversary's point of view, whether you agree with it or not, but empathy is the great neglected missing element in the peace processes today. One young scholar here was saying that she tried to come at the study of peacemaking without all those fuzzy emotions like love and respect, but inevitably came back to see those things as utterly crucial. They sound sentimental, but how do we make them real? How do we acknowledge them as kind of the realest stuff in politics?
Can I tell a story?
Please.
All right. I arrived into Albuquerque down the Sandia Mountains on the evening that the first Gulf War was declared, and I listened to it on the radio as I was driving into town back in January of 91. I was a guest professor at the University of New Mexico, and I was teaching a poetry workshop. The students came from all over the world, and all of them took their craft seriously because we were poets, which is the opposite of a politician. You know, we tell the truth. And we were sitting there, and the war had begun, and every day when we came to class, we asked this question: what is our responsibility as artists in time of war? What can we do? What should we be doing? This was in the beginning of my career as a major press writer. I was still a small press writer. I was on the border of becoming nationally known because in a few weeks, my books were going to be published by a New York publishing house. And thanks to the librarians who have always been supporting me, they invited me to come to El Paso and do a reading since they knew I was in the neighborhood, 4.5 hours away. So I said, okay, yeah, I'll come. And these librarians, and I'm a product of the Chicago Public Library, so I love librarians. If they ask me to stand on my head, I'm going to do it. So they said, can you please come to El Paso? And we have this lovely auditorium. It's just beautiful auditorium for you. So I drove to El Paso, and when I got there, I realized that librarians were much more optimistic than I was, because there was only maybe 7 people in a room that could have seated 350, and 6 of them were librarians. Now, one of them was the special guest that they had brought just for me, and this was a local poet from El Paso. And I looked, and it was my enemy. It was this big Tejano ex-convict poet who had applied for a job that I had applied for several years before in San Antonio, and I had had the misfortune of getting the job, and he had made me eat crow for the 18 months that I worked at that job. And when he met me, he patted me on the head. And he did all kinds of things to sabotage my job, including rallying the community to call me a communist and take me in front of then-Mayor Henry Cisneros and have the community waving little flags and have people sabotage and get into my typewriter and just do all kinds of things, and all the events would be failures. And there he was. When I was working at the Cultural Center in San Antonio, I was not allowed to tell him what I thought. But now I was self-employed, and I could do anything I wanted. And I thought, here you are to sabotage me yet again. But I'm going to get you. And I thought I would read my best story in my upcoming collection. And it's a story that takes place in San Antonio. It's a love story about a woman who falls in love with her exterminator and tends to romanticize things. It's very, very funny. And I said, you know, I've got to stay in character and stay in voice, so I'm not going to look at him. And usually when I read, I make eye contact with my audience. I perform a piece so that they can really feel the characters and the story. But I was aware that he was over here on my lap like a big mountain, and he was there to ruin my performance. So I would just kind of skim and look at center and to the right, and I read the story, and I'm reading the story, and I'm not in character because I'm aware out of the corner of my peripheral vision that he's right there. And then he started making some noise during my reading, and I thought, oh, that's just like him. He's going to ruin and distract my reading by making noises, but I'm just going to stay focused. I'm not going to look at him. I'm just going to read my story and just keep going till I get to the end. And then I heard some more noise coming out of his corner, and I just kept reading. I just raised my voice, and I stayed in character, and I read even better. And I heard some more noise coming out, and then I realized he was laughing. And he was laughing at the appropriate parts of the story, because it was a very funny story. And then the story ended, and all the 7 people in the audience applauded, and the librarians were delighted, and they wanted me to meet this great poet of El Paso. And I remember looking around and thinking, is there a bottle or something I can break? Do I have a weapon? Is there a stick or something? And I didn't have anything, just me. And I could feel my hands curling into little fists because I was afraid. And I stood there and I thought, come on, you mother, I'm ready for you now. I don't represent any cultural center but me. And if you're going to come and attack me, I'm ready to kill you. And he came up, and I was ready for anything. And he came up to me. And he did the one thing that I wasn't ready for. He put his hand out, and he shook my hand, and he said, that was a terrific story. Thank you. And my hand went limp like a little monkey, and I pulled it back, and I don't remember what came out of my mouth. And 4.5 hours, I drove back to Albuquerque thinking about my enemy and what he had taught me. And when I came back to my workshop, I told this story to my students. And first they all gasped because they couldn't believe that I had an enemy. And then I said, I know what we can do for peace, what we have to do for peace now, this very moment, in this classroom, is you and I must make peace with each other. We have to be peace. We don't have to hold up a sign. We have to be peace, which is hard, because you have to not fight with your mother or the other poet across the room who you think is trying to one-up you, or the other person in your department, or your neighbor, or your brother. And that's much more difficult than standing on the corner and saying, stop the war now. So we all shifted, and we said, we all have no conflicts here. We will work at making peace because there is war, and we're going to extend that peace outside of this room to every day so that we will try to be peace. And that poet was the Hano poet Ricardo Sanchez, and I cannot believe that lesson that he taught me. And I've told this story on the City Hall steps when the Ku Klux Klan came to town, and I've told it in interdenominational services when we've rallied for peace. And I thank him for being such a Zen teacher to teach me how to be peace.
Thank you, Sandra. Thank you. John Hunter is a prize-winning teacher in Charlottesville, Virginia. He invented the World Peace Game for kids in the fourth grade range of primary school, all about the principles of nonviolence in a violent world. Explain as simply as you can, John, how that World Peace Game works. Mm. It calls upon kids to confront the reality of chaos and deal with it. How do you get it to work on grown-ups and warriors and statesmen, as well as it does on fourth graders?
I don't know. We've tried it with children. We've worked with high school students, and they've been very successful. I'm almost a little shy of trying it with adults, but maybe we can give it a shot someday. Maybe they'll do well. We hope so. But we essentially try to put children in completely chaotic situations that are overly complex. They are tossed in and asked to find a way out. And the reason they can do that safely, I think, is because we have a relationship and a trust to start with. Without that relationship in teaching and education, in almost any endeavor, it's very hard to go very far. So with that trust, they simply believe they can, I think, because I believe in them. We call it, we build a very attractive high diving board. It's very high, and it's very scary to jump into the deep end, but I'm in the water swimming, and the diving board we try to make so attractive that they really just have to go. It's that love and that fear of learning something new. So they're in a complex situation, over 50 interlocking global problems, and they have to solve them simultaneously if they can, or if one thing moves, everything else is affected and changes. And we read Sun Tzu's The Art of War to try and understand how we can go through it without combat if possible, but all human interactions are allowed. They can do whatever they would, whatever they wish to, and I'm simply out of the policy control position. Once the game starts, it's their game. And time again, year after year, they decide to do the best for everyone. There's no predicting it. They do it a different way every time. But it's astounding to me that they always want to do what we would call good. And sometimes they do it unorthodox ways. So it's an amazing thing to see happen.
How often does it lapse into war?
Quite often. And you see, my heart, my biases, my personal opinion says, oh, please don't go there. But they often have to go through it. And going through it, they come out the other side finding, though, that wasn't a very good idea, in a bloodless way, fortunately. And they can understand, it seems to me, on an almost cellular level, this isn't the way that the best way that things work. But it is a part of the process that may happen. So we accept the reality of it. We don't try to deny it. And we ask them to go through it and work with it and to make the best out of it they can.
Steve Del Rosso, I wonder what you think of Gandhian nonviolence, anti-violence in education, in practice, in diplomatic work, I mean, as a relevant piece of the process today, even in the Middle East. I'd say parenthetically, we saw, for me the first time, an extraordinary movie called Budrus about a town on the West Bank, Palestinian town that fought the location of the Israeli wall of separation on their turf. It was a militantly nonviolent movement, and they made a remarkable political success of it. Did that move you?
Well, I'm no expert on Gandhian nonviolence, but I think...
Why aren't we all, I wonder?
Well, I think we discovered that in this conference at some point, that we've been conditioned to think a certain way. But I think that in particular situations, James was talking about the Middle East and where nonviolence seemed to win the day in Egypt in particular, in Tunisia, but it hasn't in Libya and Syria. So there are lessons from the real world, but there are also counterexamples that tell people that there are other avenues toward their version of success.
What would it take, though, I wonder, to raise a kind of Gandhian flag of nonviolence as the way to peace, the way to Palestinian salvation, as a public banner? A, is it possible? Would people believe it? And then B,
I fear that there has been at least one or two, maybe at this point three generations of Palestinians who have been steeped in indignities and hate, that it would be a very difficult marketing challenge, shall we say, to convince them that nonviolence was the route to address their problems. I'm not saying it's impossible, but my view of it is, we talked about at this conference, you know, what peace is, and I don't think there was a consensus, and I don't think there is a consensus, or there should be a consensus, but it's sort of pieces of peace that we're looking at. And what I saw in Budrus, what I saw demonstrated by this coming together, was a piece of peace, and I think it would give someone like Andrew Carnegie hope that the world was getting better.
That's our job, is to give Andrew Carnegie hope.
Yes.
Sandra Cisneros, I wonder what you think. I mean, first of all, Gandhi would say, you know, this is not a marketing effort, and it's not a branding campaign. It's the only way to get the British out of India. And it's the only truth about himself. So, but I wonder, how do you apply this Gandhian legacy to a world that loves to ignore it?
Well, I think that we have a problem with the way we're running peace with all these generals who think the same way. They should be fired. And we should create a peace pentagon with these brilliant peacemakers in the world that are not dead. Gandhi's dead, but lots of people are alive right now that we could put together in a room. Think of the human resources if you put Desmond Tutu next to Rigoberta Menchú, and the lady Aung San Suu Kyi, if you brought her together and put her next to Marshall Rosenberg and his Foundation for Nonviolent Communication and Mediation. And just think about that. Nelson Mandela, you know, we could all come up with lists of people that are thinking outside the box, that are very creative. Put them all together in a room and create a peace pentagon, and, you know, really draw the people that are invested and creative and brilliant and geniuses in looking at other models for resolving conflict other than the generals that I think should be fired.
That's a puzzle for me. James and Sandra, the Peace Pentagon is going to be a laugh line wherever you speak it, almost, even here. certainly in the professional circles that you move in, James and Steve. And yet, we know that's the truth. And we know that it's what the people want.
I don't mind being ridiculed. I'm at that stage in my career, I think, that I've studied war for 20 years. And I think one of the reasons why we chose the art of peace as opposed to the art of war is because I think we're witnessing something and new possibilities that that it's no longer as ridiculous as it might have sounded. I mean, it's easy for people who didn't live through the 60s or were in somehow or another offended by the 60s to misinterpret that history. But this was a time when people did come together. They might not have elevated, as they tried to do, or levitate, rather, the Pentagon. But they did a pretty good job of stopping the war. You know, they put the pressure on, and they did that with a little help from the media and eventually from
Henry Kissinger
and other people who said, well, geez, maybe we better get on this bandwagon too. So I'm not, you know, I'm sanguine, and I'm also at the same time a utopian realist. I think that you have to have these aspirations, but you have to be totally realistic about cost and benefits. What I'm really saddened by is that the visions we had of the past, you know, visions of the past for the future, have been bankrupted. They've, you know, the Soviet Union bankrupted a vision of peace. We've seen a vision of peace coming out of the Enlightenment tradition, bankrupted, I think, in many ways on how it became hijacked by humanitarian hawks or the people who thought you had to bomb for peace. So I think it is the time, it is the right moment to subject ourselves or be willing to be subject to ridicule, not take ourselves too seriously about this project, but at the same time not allow a little laughter at us or a little laughter among us to stop us from pursuing this.
It sounds like a good bet to me. It certainly is a coherent argument, James, and I congratulate you on pulling so many interesting variations on the theme together. Thank you all. James Dedarian, Steve Del Rosso, John Hunter, Sandra Cisneros, thank you all. Ben Mandelkern produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over until you feed back on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Leiden. Thank you for being part of the conversation.